Let's turn in our Bibles tonight, if you would, to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 11. Ecclesiastes, chapter 11. Our text tonight will be the first half of the chapter. Very interesting passage of Scripture. As the wise man, as the preacher, is sharing now in this section of the book of Ecclesiastes, the wisdom that he has gained in life, and particularly he is pointing to the wisdom that comes from God, there is much for us to learn. Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verses 1 through 6, talks about a simple and singular principle that has to do with risk and reward. And the principle that is spoken about in this chapter has applications to many different parts of our life, where we especially do risk and reward analyses. And so often we think of finance or business in regards to risk and reward, but really we do this type of analysis all the time in many, many different areas of life. For instance, how we're going to invest in our family, how we're going to invest in our spiritual growth, our surrender to God, our sanctification, how we're going to invest in sharing the gospel with those around us, and on we could go tonight as we think about risk and reward. We'll try to make some applications along the way, but I think it's important that we get this principle and that we internalize it tonight. And my goal tonight for the message is that you would go away from here understanding the importance of sowing. Sowing must take place if you are ever going to reap. It is impossible to reap without sowing. Look at verse 1, Ecclesiastes chapter 11. The scripture says, "Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. Give a portion to seven, and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. If the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. And if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. He that observeth the wind shall not sow, and he that regardeth the clouds shall not reap. As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. In the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thine hand, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper either this or that, or whether they both shall be alike good." Tonight, I'd like to speak to you for just the next few moments about risk and reward. Certainly, in every decision that we make in our lives, we calculate the level of risk and the possibility of reward in the particular decision that we are making. For instance, you may have been coming home from work today and run into a little bit of a traffic jam. And in that moment, perhaps your GPS recalculated and said, if you go this direction, you could save 5 minutes. And so in that moment, perhaps you were doing some mental math, and perhaps as you looked at the map, you thought, I know that way, and I'm not so sure it's going to save 5 minutes. I think I'm going to decide to stay here. Now, you may have either regretted or rejoiced in that decision. Or perhaps you made a decision to get off the road. I remember several years ago, we were coming back from the airport after a very long flight, and we were picked up at Newark Airport. And on our way back from on I-78, all of a sudden, the traffic stopped to a parking lot, and it wasn't moving at all. And I remember, I think it was Brother Brian who was driving us, and I quick looked up and I said, okay, I think if you get off here, we could save some time. Bad decision. Everyone else was doing the same thing and trying to get off, and we ended up in a major traffic jam off to the side of the road, and I regretted that we had taken that risk. There's been other times when I have made a decision and rejoiced in the decision that I made because I felt like the reward that I received was worth the decision that I made. I'm sure that you can identify seasons like this in your life. And in fact, this is a process that we go through nearly every day and multiple times per day. Now, you'll notice in verse 1, there's an interesting picture which he paints for us. And in verse 1 and verse 2, he's recommending to us a truth or a principle that we all ought to consider in our lives. You'll notice that he says two things. He uses two metaphors, if you will, here. And he is driving home a principle or a spiritual truth. The first one in verse 1, he says, cast thy bread upon the waters. Now, right away, if you're thinking of a loaf of bread from the grocery store cut into slices in a bag and thrown onto the water, or perhaps you're thinking about when you used to go down to the duck pond as a kid and cast your bread out upon the water, I think you have the wrong picture here. That's not what the wise man is trying to drive home, not at all what he's trying to communicate to us, but rather the picture seems to be of a farmer who is sowing his seed upon the waters. We're told that in the ancient days, the farmers, especially there in Egypt, would go down along the Nile, and when the waters had flooded out of the Nile, there was a season when just before the waters would go back and recede into the banks of the Nile, the farmers would go down into that rich area where the soil was so powerfully rich, and they would take their seed and they would cast it there and allow it to settle down through the water into the mud that was below. In due season, the waters would recede and the seed would be accepted into that rich soil, and by, there would be a rich harvest of grain that would come from that. Now you say, well, it doesn't say to cast your seed upon the waters. It says to cast your bread upon the waters. And I think there's a reason for that. And what an interesting thought it is, because a farmer would typically, now in this day, you didn't go down to Agway and buy seed for the year to cast out upon the field. But what they would do is every year they would save a portion of the seed from the harvest. They would store it in a dry place, and then the next year they would go out and they would cast that seed. The rest of the seed, let's say if they were growing wheat, the rest of that grain would be used for their dietary needs, to prepare food for the family. They would take that grain and they would grind it up into a flour and be able to make breads and certain things like that. Now, when he says, cast thy bread upon the waters, he seems to have in mind that not only would we cast the seed which we have saved out for the purpose of sowing, but also in the anticipation of a great harvest, we would go and dip into the reserves of that which is there for our food, and we would risk that, and we would sow it into the ground, hoping that we would receive a greater harvest than if we had only sown the seed that we had set aside for the farm for that year. Now, in order to do this, you'll notice that the farmer is going to have to restrict his pleasure. He's going to have to forego some pleasure, maybe not have quite as much bread, maybe not have that big party that he was planning for, but because he is anticipating a harvest, he's willing to forego some pleasure to cast even his bread upon the water. We'll come back to that thought towards the end of the message. In verse 2, he says, give a portion to 7 and also to 8. Now, there's two ideas about what this means. Either one could be true, but I think one is more likely. Many people believe that it's speaking here in verse 2 about being generous towards those who have needs. And as we look around and we see maybe 7 or 8 people around us who have a need, we take what we have and we try to use that to be a blessing to them. And certainly that's a biblical principle. It's something that all of us ought to try to do in our lives, to be generous to others and to try to help their needs, to relieve the needs of those around us. Jesus talked about how important it is to give a cup of cold water in his name. And when we do that, we'll receive a reward. So certainly the Bible speaks about this. But I don't think that's what verse 2 is talking about, based on the context of the rest of the passage. I believe instead what he's speaking about here is giving is a man with resources giving an investment or a stewardship to 7 or even 8 different stewards to take that money and then invest it wisely for him with the anticipation that there will be a return. Like Jesus talked about the wealthy man who had the talents and he gave it to his servants and he anticipated that each of them would invest it wisely and come back with a return. And that's what this seems to be talking about when he says to give a portion to seven and also to eight. In other words, to be generous in your investment towards the future, in that which you put to work anticipating some sort of a return. Now you'll notice, going along with these two verses, there is a definite reward that is mentioned in each of these verses. In verse number one, he says, if we cast our bread upon the water, after many days thou shalt find it. Most farmers anticipate that when they cast the seed, when they plant the seed out in the field, that by and by there's going to be a harvest. Most of the time, that's what's going to happen. He speaks about then in verse 2 that we should give a portion to seven and also to eight. And the reason is because thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. You don't know what kind of calamities might be coming. You don't know what kind of difficulties you might face. You don't know whether one investment might fail. And if you put all of your emphasis in that one investment, then you would have nothing left. But if you, in the investing world, they talk about diversifying your portfolio. If you diversify your investments, there's a good chance that you're going to receive a reward, even if some evil comes upon the world. So he speaks about this recommendation. Now remember, keep this in your mind because we're talking about sowing. It's important for us to sow. Now he's going to expand upon this idea of sowing, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about some of the risk. Because you ought to be aware that no matter what decisions you make in your life, there are always risks. He says in verse 3, if the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth, and if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. You say, wait a second, what is he talking about? I believe in verse 3, he's talking about things that you and I have no control over. Do you know, when there's clouds in the sky that are full of rain, there's a good chance that it's going to rain. There's a good chance that a storm is going to come. Now, not always. Sometimes that storm will blow over, and we find this sometimes here in the Lehigh Valley, that the storms will looks like they're coming, and then they split around the valley, and we miss it all together, and all around us we get rain. In our place, we don't get rain. We can't really control where the rain falls and where the rain doesn't fall. We can't make the clouds happen, although I know that scientists think they have figured that out, and there's a little bit of maybe some trouble with that, figuring out how to make clouds and then make it rain. You've been reading about that in the news, haven't you? In fact, I think, Brother Jeff, that you all in Dubai may have been the recipients of some of that manipulation of the weather, and nearly made sure that they went as missionaries to Dubai and stayed there. But anyway, regardless of what men think, what we find out is that the weather is actually pretty hard to control. It's something that even though men think, scientists think, that they can really control these things, they don't have such good control of them. So the clouds can fall, and trees can fall. They can fall in any direction. I don't know if you've ever had a tree fall on your house or a tree fall on a car or on a garage. I just read a tragic story over the weekend that not far from here, some folks were camping in a campground and a tree fell on their camper and the lady in the camper lost her life. Now, you couldn't anticipate that a tree is going to fall. Now, some of you are thinking right now, that's exactly why I don't go camping, and you'll never find me in the woods ever again sleeping after I've heard that. The truth is, most of the time, trees don't fall. Most of the time, the trees stay up, but you couldn't anticipate when the tree is going to go over or when it's not going to go over, and if it does go over, where it's going to fall. But wherever it falls, and I love the irony of Scripture, there it shall be. There it is. I remember after Hurricane Sandy. Some of you remember Hurricane Sandy when it blew through. And we had a mighty wind that night. And some trees fell down. I think we lost five locust trees in that storm. They were all close to 100 feet tall. And they fell right on top of the shed in the back. And you know what? There they were. There they were. And then I went to sleep, and when I woke up in the morning, they were still there. And they stayed there until I got up the energy to fire up the chainsaw and climb on top of the garage and the shed and cut it up into pieces and get it off of there. Because when trees fall, they fall. There's nothing you can do about it. There's nothing to stop it. You could try to get under the tree and stop it from falling, but it's not going to do any good. And you're probably not going to be able to divert it. If you doubt that, you could watch some funny videos on YouTube of people trying to divert a tree. Once it starts going a certain direction, it's gone. That's it. All right, now think about this. There are things that happen in our life that are completely outside of our control. What does this have to do with the theme here? Remember, the theme is sowing. The theme is the decisions that we make. There are risks and rewards. You know, there are some people who are so afraid of risk that they are paralyzed to inaction, and they think that they are preserving their life. They think that they are keeping themselves from evil or from any sort of difficulty, and actually their inaction and their lack of decision is causing them more problems than if they had just risked something and made a decision. You understand that there is a need for us in our lives to make decisions whether there are risks or not. We cannot mitigate all of the risks that exist in our life. But many people are so afraid of risk that they spend all the moments of their life worrying about what might happen if something goes wrong and avoiding any investment in the future because of a fear of loss. I've talked, for instance, to people who say, I would never put my money in the bank. I would never invest it in the stock market. I would never, ever, ever put it in an interest-bearing account because I might lose it. Might come as a great surprise to you. But if you just put it into cash and stuff it under your mattress where it'll be nice and safe, you'll lose somewhere between 4 and 7% a year. So you made a decision and you tried to preserve it and actually you ended up losing. Do you understand what I'm saying? There are risks, and there's risks in every part of our life, and we can either worry about those risks or we can make the best decision we possibly can and step forward by faith. Now, go to verse 4 because this all flows together. There's risks. There's a principle that we need to follow that we're always needing to be sowing. But there's risks that exist. And now he warns us in verse number 4 about a resistance that we tend to have to sowing. And sowing is really representative of decisions that we make of how to invest. How to invest our money, how to invest our time, how to invest the talents that we have. How are we going to invest these things? He says in verse 4, "He that observeth the wind shall not sow, and he that regardeth the clouds shall not reap." What is the resistance that we have? Well, the man who observes the wind and regards the clouds thinks that he can predict the future. And he thinks that he can anticipate what is going to happen. For instance, in his mind, he says, "Looks like rain today. I see some clouds. Best not take the tractor out in the fields." Now, it might rain or it might not rain, but I guarantee you this, if he doesn't take the tractor out in the fields, no seed is getting sown. Or maybe he looks at the wind and he tries to anticipate which way the wind is blowing. Oh, it looks like it's coming from the north. Oh, it's a strong wind. I'll bet there's a storm coming. Or maybe he looks at it, feels like a dry wind. I bet we're about ready to enter into a drought. I probably shouldn't go out and sow any seed right now. Isn't that the emphasis of verse 4? He's looking at the weather thinking he can predict the future, and his decision is, "I'm better off not doing anything." Many people, because of their ability, I'm putting that in strong air quotes, their ability to predict the future,
There's a recession coming. The world is really getting bad. Everything is getting evil. I don't think that we need to be careful not to overextend ourselves.
You know, you're making a decision by that. Now, we'll come back and see how this applies in just a moment. But the idea of verse 4 is that if we are always trying to anticipate what might happen, we never will get around to doing what we ought to do. We'll be so busy trying to figure out the future that we have no time to invest in the present moment. You know, this happened to some of the believers in Thessalonica, and actually it's the theme of the first epistle that was written to that church. Some of the people began to think that the Lord Jesus was either he had already returned or his return was so soon that they might as well stop working. They might as well quit their jobs, and they might as well go and just wait for Jesus to come back. And basically what Paul said to them was, get back to work. Get back to living your life. You don't know when Jesus is coming back, but you know what you ought to be doing while you wait. And God never told you to sit there on a hill and wait for Jesus to come back. He gave us some things that we ought to be doing. So there's a resistance that we tend to have. What is that resistance? Well, for one thing, and you might be able to identify with this when you were a child especially, or maybe if you have some children at home, you can recognize this in them. There was a time in our life, and hopefully it's not still this way, that we could come up with any excuse to not have to work. Dad would say, mow the lawn. We'd look outside. I see some clouds over there, Dad. I don't think I'm going to be able to get it in. I might as well just wait till tomorrow. Now, if Dad was wise, he probably said, get out there and mow the grass until the rain starts. If the rain starts, you're welcome to come back in, but get as much done as you can before it starts raining. I don't know how many times I went out to mow the grass thinking it might rain any time and managed to finish the whole lawn before the rain ever did come, or maybe it didn't at all. You see, the resistance that we tend to have is we don't like to risk and we don't like to work. We like to be lazy. We like to hold back. We like to let other people do our work for us. And so he says, be careful about putting too much stock in what you think you know about the future. You probably don't know half as much as you think you do. Verse 5, he's continuing the thought now. As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. So he mentions two specific things here and then compares them to our lack of knowledge about the work of God. First of all, he says, thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit. And the way of the Spirit, we could apply this to the inner part of man, the part of man that communes with God. We could also apply this to the Spirit of God himself and the way that the Spirit of God works. And what's interesting is that in the Bible, the word which describes the Spirit of God means the wind. And when Jesus was talking about the moving of the Spirit of God in John chapter 3, he said, the wind bloweth where it listeth. And the point was, you have no idea where it's coming from or where it's going to. And Jesus said, that's exactly like how the Spirit of God works. You see, the way of the Spirit, you look at a person and you wonder what's going on inside of them. What are they thinking? What is it that God is doing in their life? And sometimes you'll look at someone and you'll make a judgment about what you think is going on in their life. Maybe even as an evangelist, you're thinking about who should I share the gospel with? And you observe someone, you think, well, they're never going to be interested. And then you see they'll definitely be interested. And how many times has it happened to me where it was completely the opposite? The person that I thought would be interested wasn't interested at all. And the person who I thought would be really resistant to the message of the gospel was wide open to talking about spiritual things. Be careful about thinking you know the way of the Spirit. Be careful of thinking that you know the way that God is working or what God is going to do. Be careful about thinking that you fully understand another person or their motivations or what it is that drives them to do the things that they do. You don't know the way of the Spirit. You also don't know how the bones grow in the womb. The miracle of birth. How is it that God designed for a child to grow in the womb of its mother until the time of its birth? That is a miraculous thing. Scientists today, of course, they can show us inside the womb what is happening. We can see pictures and ultrasounds and all this sort of thing, but they still have no idea how it happens. They don't know what is actually taking place or how all of that happens, but God designed that in such a way that we would stand in awe of His power. And that's why He says in verse 5, in the same way that you don't know these things, and it would be very foolish for you to presume that you do, you also do not know the works of God who maketh all. There are many things that we do not understand about what God is up to. As we look in our own life, as we observe in the lives of other people, as we make decisions about how we're going to spend our minutes and our hours and our days, how we're going to invest the resources that God gives to us, we never really know exactly what God is up to. Now, sometimes we can take a guess and we can say, well, I think that this must be what God is doing. I believe that I sense that God is working over here, but the truth is, you don't really know. In fact, some people have suggested that what we ought to do is only do spiritual sowing in situations where we know that God is at work. Therefore, we will not waste our time and will be more efficient. Because as Americans, we're all about efficiency. Except, that's unscriptural. You see, when's the last time you saw a farmer with a seed looking at that seed and saying, I wonder if this one is going to be the big one? No, what he does is he puts it in the ground and he covers it up, and then he puts another one in the ground and another one in the ground and another one in the ground because he really doesn't know which of those seeds is going to bring forth the most fruit. Now, in verse 6, there's a restatement of the principle, and he really drives it home for us, and he helps us understand what it is that he's getting at, and then we're going to make some application. He says, in the morning, sow thy seed, and in the evening, withhold not thine hand, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper either this or that, or whether they both shall be alike good. Now, what is he saying? Sow in the morning and sow in the evening. He's saying, just get out there. If you're a farmer, just get out there and plant seed. And plant a lot of it. Plant all day long. Keep on planting and planting. Brother Jason Byler, who's a friend of mine, he pastors in North Carolina. He preached at the conference we were at here recently. Brother Byler grew up on a dairy farm. And when he was a boy, they would, of course, milk the cows, but they also had to plant the fields. And they did a lot of their planting the old-fashioned way. And he talked in his message about the fact that they never did worry too much about what was going to happen to the seed. They just went out there and put the seed in the ground. And then they expected that something was going to come of it. Sow in the morning and sow in the evening. Give your resources every day, all day, to planting seeds that can bring forth fruit. You don't know which seeds in particular are going to bring forth the most fruit, but don't worry yourself by trying to figure that out. In other words, let's use the example of handing out tracts, and you're going to walk along the street and think, now, which person should I give a tract to? Well, it'd be better to take 50 and just hand out 50 tracts to 50 people than to take one and try to figure out the one person that you're supposed to give a tract to. You got a much better chance if you give out 50 of finding the one who might be open. You understand what I'm saying? Instead of always trying to figure out which one, where do I really plant this one seed, you ought to be just consistent in planting seeds. Sow in the morning, sow in the evening. In other words, and this is what he's driving at, just do what you are supposed to do. You don't know the future, and you can't anticipate what is the best thing in the moment. So just be faithful to do the thing that you know to do. Farmers plant seeds. A farmer who never plants seeds never gets a harvest. A Christian who never plants seeds never gets a harvest. Make sure that you are busy doing the things that you ought to do. I'd like to use an analogy just for a moment regarding baseball. How many of you like baseball? A few of you, all right? I love baseball. I grew up playing baseball. My dad loved baseball. His dad loved baseball. And so we always loved baseball in our house. But my dad always told me something about baseball, which I have found to be true. He said, "Son, it's much better to learn how to be a base hitter. Somebody who can get on base consistently is much more valuable than the person who can hit a home run every once in a while. Because the guy who can swing the bat, and most of the time, let's say, if you know anything about batting averages, let's say that 40 or 50% of the time he could get on base with a hit, that's a really good player. That's somebody who's really valuable, and in fact, you'll find that that kind of a person will win games for their team. Now, what is spectacular is the home run. Everybody wants to see a home run. When we go to a baseball game, boy, we want to see somebody hit it out of the park, and that's wonderful. You know, if a batter is consistent and they learn to swing and they're swinging for a base hit, every once in a while they make good contact and they hit a home run. But see, that's not what you should ever be doing if you're in the batter's box. You should have a more modest goal. I'd just like to get on base. Because once somebody gets on base, now you have a potential run for your team that's in the field. Are you understanding what I'm saying? So many times in our Christian life, we're trying to hit a home run in every area of our life. We're trying to hit a home run in raising our kids. We're going to figure out the secret key, and we're going to show everybody that we know how to raise superstar kids for the Lord. Or, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to be an evangelist, and I'm going to show everybody how to win souls for Jesus, and I'm going to find that key person, and I'm going to win them for the Lord, and that's going to start this huge movement, and lots of people are going to get saved. And you know what? It's wonderful when those things happen. But most of the time, those things happen not because somebody figured out the secret key or figured out how to hit spiritual home runs, but rather because they were faithful. They did the same things over and over and over again. Whether it's raining or whether it's sunshiny or the wind's blowing or it's still as could be, whether it's the morning or the night, they just keep sowing. They just keep investing. They just keep putting their effort into doing the things that they know they ought to do. I enjoy learning about investing. And we could debate about the best way to invest and what's the best system and all that sort of thing. And of course, you're probably familiar that there's people who are day traders and people who like to trade all sorts of different derivatives in the market. But by and large, for the average person, what is the best way to invest? Well, experts will tell you the best thing that you could possibly do is something called dollar cost averaging. Forget about where the market's going and just consistently invest in the market in a nice diversified type of a way and do it every single month. And if you do that, you're going to get lots of base hits, And every once in a while, you'll hit some home runs, and most people who have the discipline to do that end up being millionaires because they learned something. You tend to accumulate wealth through faithful preservation of the resources that God has given to you. This is the same in so many different areas of life. So often we are looking for some kind of a secret key, some way to hit a home run, some way to do something spectacular or big. And what God is really interested in, and this is shown from the book of Genesis to the book of Revelation, what God is interested in is people who are faithful. Never despise the day of small things. Small things are not small at all, because small things tend to add up to big things. And if you learn to be faithful in the daily things, if you learn to be faithful in the little things, the things that most people disdain, you will find that God blesses that, and you are going to receive some rewards. Now, why do we not sow in this way in our lives? For instance, why is it more appealing to people to be unfaithful in their parental responsibilities than it is to be faithful? Why is it more appealing for people to be unfaithful as a believer or a church member than it is for them to be faithful? Why is it today that it's more appealing to people to be unfaithful in their marriage vows than it is for them to be faithful? Why is it that everybody is looking for the spectacular, that everybody is looking for the big thing? I have a couple of suggestions for you. I think one reason that this happens is because you and I love pleasure all too much. You know, if you're going to cast your bread upon the water, that means, if we speak in a financial sense or in a farmer sense, to cast your bread upon the water means that you're going to have to restrict your intake of bread a little bit. You're not going to have quite that sumptuous feast that you were looking for, because you're going to take something and you're going to invest it with the hope of return. One of the biggest problems that is taking place in our society and in our culture right now is that, by and large, across the board, there is no self-denial and no self-discipline. There is only this desire to consume what we have. And the philosophy goes like this: well, what good is having it if you can't enjoy it? And I understand what is being said, and I understand the philosophy, but you need to get a hold of this, that in order to have something, in general, you have to invest something. You have to put something into it. It's like if you want to be successful in a particular career path or to be successful in a certain job, then you're probably going to have to start at the bottom and work your way up. I don't know anybody, any companies that are hiring 18-year-old CEOs and saying, hey, you are so smart, let's put you at the top of the company. And if they are, whatever company that is, sell their stock right away, because it's going to be a disaster. You see what I'm saying? But so often people don't want to deny themselves. They want to have everything and enjoy it. This is why we have people today who, for instance, say, I don't have enough money to buy food for my family, while they're holding their $1,200 iPhone with a $50 plan. There's something wrong. I remember one time visiting some folks, and they said, we are really hard up. We don't have any money. And I mean, it was hard, because I'm looking here in their living room. They have the largest television I have ever seen in my life. It literally covered the entire wall. And they were all watching cable, which I know what that costs. And I'm thinking, I think I could help you come up with some money to buy food for your kids if you really wanted. You understand what I'm saying? But they don't want to deny themselves. They want someone else to meet their needs. But the sad thing about that is they're not sowing any seeds, so there's never going to be anything for the future. When you see somebody who has something, maybe they have a nice house, they have a nice car, they have some money in the bank. How did they get that? Well, most of the time, through hard work, self-denial, and diligent saving, so that they could have something for the future. But so many people get to the end and they say, I don't have anything at all. I just never had enough. Well, you have to learn to deny yourself to be able to sow some seeds. Loving pleasure will also keep you from serving God. Because many people, they want the glamorous spot. They want to be in the limelight. They want the place where it's fun and it's enjoyable. But a whole lot of things in the Christian life aren't fun and aren't enjoyable, and nobody's watching, and there's not going to be a write-up in the bulletin, or nobody's going to send out an email and say, I noticed this person doing such and such. It's just what you do. Many parents are not investing in their children and not fulfilling their responsibility because, frankly, they're too tired, they're too interested in their pleasures, and that just takes too much time. If you love pleasure, you're going to have a lot of difficulty investing in many different areas of life. How about the second thing, the second reason we don't invest like this, we don't sow these seeds, is because we fear the future. We're so afraid of what might happen. What is going to happen? Oh no, I think that the world is getting really bad. I agree. I think that we might have some real economic problems. I agree. I think that things could get really rough. I agree. But what are you going to do about it? I mean, honestly, what are you going to do about it? You say, I'm going to fix it by worrying. I'm going to lay awake at night and I'm going to worry until it goes away. How does that work? We fear the future. We fear, so we don't plant seeds. We're afraid if I share the gospel with that person, they might reject the gospel. They might not like me anymore. They might not want to listen. They might get upset. So I don't think I'm going to plant seeds. I don't think I'm going to share the gospel with them. Well, how are they going to hear if you don't tell them? And how are you going to know how they're going to respond if you never take the opportunity to tell them about the gospel? You're just assuming they're going to respond that way. What if instead they say, thank you so much for telling me. I've been wanting to hear about this. Wouldn't that make your day? I'll bet if that happened, you'd come floating into church next service and say, let me tell you what happened. I went to share the gospel with this person. They said, I've been waiting for you to come. Woohoo! That's great. But how are you going to find that person? If you're never planting seeds, you're never going to have a harvest. We fear the future, so we say, well, we're going to have to pull back. We're going to have to be careful. We're going to have to be cautious. We're going to have to be conservative. Be careful about fear. Fear will bind you from many things. Many parents are so terrified of something happening to their children that they're not even letting their children grow up. They're not letting their children bear responsibility and learn how to function and live a normal life because they're terrified that something might happen to them. Listen, something might happen to them, but something could just as soon happen to them sitting in your living room as being out there doing something. You understand what I'm saying? Don't be afraid. You could go through the Bible and see how many times God says, fear not. God's people should not be afraid. So we don't sow seeds because we love pleasure, because we're fearing the future. And I think third of all, because we're waiting for the big win. We're saving up our resources for the big win, for the really big one. We're thinking that I have to invest in the best way possible. I have to make sure that I maximize my life and leverage. No, by and large, in the investing world, the best way to make money in investing is just to invest. Most people don't get the big win. Most people just make consistent returns. Most people just, every once in a while, they get successful. And you know what? It adds up. But so many of us are trying to get the big win. We're trying to be in a place where people say, wow, look how successful. Imagine, for instance, what if, as a pastor, and I'll make an application to myself. What if every time I preached, I got up in the pulpit hoping for the big win? We're going to really push to see maybe a dozen people saved. Woo, that'd be great. Wonderful. I'm looking forward to that. Now, that would change the way that I preach. Because then I would always be looking for the high-powered illustration. I'd be trying to make it super powerful so that people would hang on every word. And I'd try to move their emotions and get people to respond. But what I wouldn't be doing, I wouldn't be faithfully teaching verse by verse and chapter by chapter through the Word of God. I wouldn't be giving value to the things that don't seem to be quite as significant. They're not quite as powerful. They're not as moving. But God put them in there for a reason. You see, the truth is, how does, let's say, in a ministry, a pastor who's preaching and teaching, how do spiritual results happen, or how is there a spiritual harvest? Usually it's the result of repetitive sowing in spiritual things. Faithfulness in the Word of God. Sometimes in our generation, we think of these high-powered evangelists who have these winsome personalities and these powerful messages, and they come into town. They've got their five favorite messages, and they're going to thunder from the pulpit, and it's really going to do something. I'm going to guarantee you that if anything happens in a church in that type of a situation, it is largely owing to the quiet, faithful sowing of a faithful pastor who's been there a long time, who's been laying the foundation. And then somebody came and God used that. Praise the Lord for that if that happens. But see, most of us, instead of being faithful, we're trying to look for the big win. And God just wants us to be faithful. He just wants us to go out in the morning and sow our seed. Then He wants us to go back in the evening and sow our seed. He just wants us to do the thing that He has called us to do, whether it's important or whether it's not important, whether somebody notices or somebody doesn't notice, it really doesn't matter. He says, just go out and sow seeds. Don't regard the wind. Don't look at the clouds. Just go out and do what you're supposed to do. And what you'll find is not everything is going to prosper. Not everything is going to bring a result, but faithful sowing day in and day out and week out and month out and year out always brings a harvest. God guarantees it. So if I could sum it up, sowing seed, risk and reward, just be faithful. Be faithful. There's really are not super secrets of the Christian life. Most of the Christian life is just being faithful in what we know we ought to do. There are times when we think, I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. I don't know where to turn. I don't know what to decide in this situation. In the times when you don't know what to do, this is going to sound so, you're going to say, this doesn't make any sense. In the times when you don't know what to do, do what you know you ought to do. What should you do? Well, I should get up this morning. I should spend time with God. I should look in His Word. I should pray. I should share the gospel with the people that God brings across my path. I should be faithful to the house of God. I should be faithful to my family, to my marriage vows. I should do the things that God has told me to do. When you sum up the things that we actually know to do, that's quite significant. And if you just keep being faithful, doing the things that God has told you to do, by and by, you'll figure out the confusing things and it'll make sense and you'll be able to figure out what it is that you should do in that situation that you don't know what to do. But in the meanwhile, don't stop doing everything. Just do what God has called you to do. Sow your seed morning and evening and trust God to bring a harvest.